This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're revisiting the topic of student mental health with repeat guest Jenny Pusey. Like myself, she had her most difficult time of mental illness when she was at university, and we previously interviewed her about this, and I shared a bit of my experience during that time. That was back in our student mental health mini-series last year, if you want to scroll back through our episodes. We're also going to be talking all about our petition for mental health education. It's called Add Mental Health Education to the Mandatory Teaching Curriculum for All UK Schools. If you haven't yet signed that, maybe you're new to the podcast, you can find it by visiting bit.ly/mentalpetition. That link will also be in the full episode description. If you have already signed that, thank you so much. We are now, as of recording this, at 198,000 signatures. So super, super close to the 200,000, at which point we're going to hand in the petition again, just to reinforce the public demand for these changes. However, there has been some really brilliant progress so far. Mental health education is going to be rolled out in England and in Wales from September 2020. Also, Ofsted will be taking into account mental health support as part of their grading criteria for schools across England. There's still a lot more work to be done, and in the episode we'll talk a lot more about the progress that's still needed in Scotland and Northern Ireland, but these changes so far have been really phenomenal, and we've been lucky to be part of the consultations in both cases, so I can assure you I've been very involved with the legislation, with the reforms on a, at times, exhaustingly detailed level. So these changes really will make such a difference to young lives. Also, if you want to get a general update, do visit the petition page, as we recorded a video talking all about it with me, Danielle, and with previous guest, Sean Leonard. Danielle, is there anything you wanted to say about why mental health education is important to you?
Of course there is, Bobby. There's so much that I want to say about it, but I'll keep it short. As I said on the video, I'm a mom of two girls, and I just think it's beneficial in so many ways, not only for them just to learn for their own benefit, but so importantly for benefit of others and their friends and the people that they grow with, just to understand each other and what somebody might be going through. Because that judgment or perceptions that each child has about what other people think, it's just key to start breaking down some of that from such a young age and really starting to understand that actually what other people think of us has no power to drive what we do or to have an impact if we don't want it to. And all of that will also be part of mental health education, as well as the general things that we might know that are going to be spoken about, you know, about mental illness, and that, you know, is more in our conversations. I just love the petition, and I just love what you've done with it and how hard you've worked. It's just amazing that you're doing that, and how good is it to see the changes already starting to happen? Brilliant. Yeah.
The importance applies to every child, that whilst not every child will experience mental illness through their school years, and luckily at those young ages, stigma is something that's learned, and that is planted through the current ignoring of mental health in most curriculums. The physical health and nutrition are talked about more extensively than ever, certainly more extensively than when I was at school. And yet, by ignoring mental illness that affects so many kids, and if not them, someone in their family or someone that's a friend of theirs, by ignoring that, it establishes a precedent that we don't talk about that. And that's where the stigma comes from. It's learned. You're not born as a baby having misinformed or discriminatory feelings towards those that experience mental illness. It's learned.
Yeah. And also, even taking a bit of pressure. There's so many problems with exams and academic pressure. It's a good thing to even just reduce an hour of some lesson that we learn that's just adding pressure on, that's potentially got no benefit in later on in life, and learn something that is definitely going to be beneficial. Even that, is a benefit. Yeah,
no, definitely, because in that simplest way, well, if they're learning about things like sex ed that is happening outside of school, yeah, we hope, yeah, then they should be learning about stress management.
Absolutely.
And what to do if any mental illness symptoms come up when they're in a stressful environment. Exam stress is part of school life, yeah, realistically. And so why wouldn't it make sense for some basic coping mechanisms, well, yeah, to be taught?
And also it might, you know, we might feed some messages through to parents who aren't maybe as aware of mental illness or don't support mental health as much as other people do. And maybe some kids will be going back and talking to the parents about it, because there are a lot of parents out there that put a lot of pressure on their kids to succeed academically. And I think they might need a bit of a rain check now and again as well.
Right, absolutely. And one of the massive misconceptions is, in terms of prevalence of mental illness, that a lot of people think that's something that just magically springs up in adulthood. Whereas when you think about it, particularly around puberty, there's a lot of emotional and body changes going on anyway that can make it really fertile time for your mental health to take a fall. It's an absolutely a vulnerable time for people. And one of the stats we actually used on the petition really highlights that. Over half of all mental ill health starts before the age of 14. 75% of this has developed by the age of 18.
Wow.
So as much as we can talk about the importance of better understanding so that peers can look out for each other and be more empathetic towards friends around them that are struggling, there's actually so much prevalence of mental illness that needs support there already. It's not just about how you can understand for your adult life. There are kids struggling with their mental health now. Other than sleeping, they spend the most time in school than any other environment. So it seems like a perfectly natural place for this education to be included.
Well, absolutely. And they've also, the World Health Organization, they've lowered the age in which they're surveying children and young people and recording statistical data around mental illness now down to 5. It was 8. It's been lowered to 5. So there's actually data now on mental illness from 5 to 18-year-olds. And when you look at it, it's worrying. There's so many young carers, which is another big thing, and we don't realise the impact. So there's a lot of work to do, like you said, but this has to be mandatory and in place ASAP.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly, with all the things we've done through this podcast, this is the most far-reaching project. This is going to influence so many lives. That's so exciting, because potentially a few generations will go past and we'll reach a point where most people in this country have had mental health education. And that is,
wow, it's exciting.
Incredible to think. It's a little bit difficult to like wrap your head around at times, yeah, to just think how far-reaching this impact could be. Mm. So thank you to everyone listening that signed the petition. If you haven't already, do go ahead, click the link, get your signature on there. It really does make a difference. And so in a moment, we'll get into the interview with Jenny Pusey, all about her experience of mental illness. We're going to be revisiting her story in a kind of summary form and looking at what's happened since I last interviewed her. And she'll share some really incredible insight on what it's like experiencing mental illness while studying, what kind of support is out there now, what gaps there are that she sees. And also, she's a medical student, so she can see how far-reaching this work will be, even within industries like medicine, where you'd think stigma is better managed, but there can still be a lot of stigma, even in industries where you think they'd know better. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that does come from lack of understanding and misinformation and limited education right from school age. So I'm really delighted to get to sit down with her again. She's such a delight. Yeah, a lovely, insightful person. So we'll get into that episode with Jenny in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. So when I last spoke to you, you'd had time out of university as a medical student, and then you'd recently gone back. And so it was a really nice kind of full circle moment. If listeners are new and haven't heard that episode, Do you mind sharing a little bit of background on what led to you taking some time out of uni?
Yeah, so it was mainly in my first year when I started becoming really unwell. Depression, anxiety symptoms, just kind of muddled through as much as I could for the next several years. But ultimately, halfway through my fourth year, it was, everything just got really bad and I was asked to take time out. And even though at first it wasn't my own decision, after that I went on to take another 2 years out just to focus on my own mental health and to focus on therapy as well before coming back and finishing the course.
So just to clarify a little bit for the listeners there, where you talk about it not being entirely your decision, that was to do with the kind of medical body around you seeing how unwell you were?
Yeah, so at the time I was on clinical placements and I was just too unwell to be there really, and I wasn't engaged, and I think my tutors had noticed that something wasn't right. So the wellbeing team for the med school called me in for a meeting and sort of put their foot down and said I needed to take time out.
Yeah, and that's completely understandable. They were concerned about your wellbeing, but also you're not going to be able to look after your patients properly.
Yeah, and I think at the time, I remember leaving that meeting and thinking it was the end of the world, and was also quite angry that they'd made that decision. But in hindsight, I didn't have the insight to realise just how unwell I was. And it is only looking back on it that I would have, if I was one of them looking in, I think I would have made the exact same decision.
Absolutely. And so you then had your time out and you've mentioned therapy. What kind of things were helping you to get better?
Yeah, so at first, quite a lot of it, I was still bouncing in and out of hospital and intensive home treatment. A lot of it was going on waiting lists, I think, as well. So I did some MBT courses and ultimately got onto a DBT course, which is seen as, I think, the gold standard for EUPD. So that was like quite intense, it was 18 months, but I found that that was quite a game changer.
Yeah. If listeners aren't familiar with DBT, it's closest to CBT as a type of therapy that's there to enable you with a specific toolkit of how to look after your mental health.
Yeah, definitely. It really focuses on helping with the symptoms and on, I'd say, managing your emotions and what your response is to those emotions are. So instead of using more sort of negative coping techniques like self-harm and sort of a lot of people have like binge drinking or binge eating, mm-hmm. you can find more positive ways.
And again, I feel like I'm rushing through it. Our last episode was a lot longer talking through all this stuff in a lot more depth. But one thing we didn't talk about much was what happened kind of after you'd gone back to uni.
Yeah, so I've been back just over a year now, and initially going back, I was quite terrified, I think, because it had been so long. I think it was a big mixture of worrying about how I'd cope for the course itself, worrying that I would have forgotten everything, all the knowledge that I needed to go back into the point of the course that I was going into. At this point, all my friends had graduated, so I was going into a brand new year group, and the worry of, what if I don't make any friends? What if I'm just that loner who kind of sits in the corner of a lecture theatre for the next 3 years that I still had to go? And also just about whether I'd get the sort of support that I needed or if it would just cause my mental health to spiral out of control again. But I found actually it was almost an anticlimax because everything went pretty well. A lot of that was down to using the DBT skills and almost in some ways over-preparing mm-hmm. for any sort of disasters that could happen as I went back. So any kind of blips or challenges that I came across, I already had a lot of plans as to how I would cope with those, and that massively helped. In some ways, it sounds a bit cheesy, but I think those few years as well, like you grew up quite a lot in it. I think I just had a bit more life experience, and so things which I would have really struggled with before, things like speaking with a lot of the doctors and nurses on the ward, where before there's a big age gap, but now I was the same age as a lot of them, so I felt like I could talk to them more as peers instead of being quite intimidated by them as well. The whole worry about not having any friends, everyone was so friendly. And I literally, on the first day, went in, just sat next to some random people and just said to them that I'm new in the year, I don't know anybody. And from there, like, everyone was just nice people. I think, I don't know, in my mind I'd built it up into being this really terrifying scenario that everyone, for some reason, would ignore me.
That's so great to hear. And it's interesting what you mentioned about having the time away and kind of growing up a bit, because we have that in common, that we've both had our worst periods of mental illness whilst at university. Unlike you, of course, I didn't go back. And interestingly, right from the beginning, I got on a lot with the mature students, because for them, usually they're going into it giving things up. You know, they've probably got a job, they may or may not have like family and kids that they're moving away from or taking the time away from to study. Yeah. And so it's such a massive life change for anyone, because I was also leaving a job and moving away from family and all my support network to somewhere I didn't know anyone. I could kind of relate to that more than I could relate to a lot of the younger students, where this isn't all of them, but certainly a lot that I was around were there because they got to the end of school and they didn't know what to do yet.
Yeah.
So they just defaulted to more study. And that just seemed like the obvious next step, as opposed to something they'd maybe chosen as a life move in the same way the mature students had.
Yeah. And you know, actually, that made me think that last autumn I was helping out at one of the med school's open days that was for kind of sixth form students who were thinking about applying for medicine and wanting to pick what unis they were going to apply for. And I think what I wasn't prepared for was how many students that I would see, that it would be quite obvious that they weren't really wanting to do medicine, but their parents were kind of leading the show a bit. And
that's interesting, because I guess maybe I somewhat stereotyped that medicine is the kind of career where, maybe in part because of the longer course, it's one that is more of a commitment and maybe people would be more sure about.
Yeah, and I think, don't get me wrong, the majority of the teens who were there really wanted to do medicine. It was their own decision and they were really passionate about it. But there are definitely a few where it felt like they were kind of in the background. Their parents would be there. The parents would be the ones asking all the questions. I think being one of the student volunteers as well, we would get a lot of very specific questions about what extracurricular activities does my child need, what grades do they need, what volunteering should we be getting them to do, instead of actually kind of thinking, well, what do they want to do? And yeah, I think there were some who would, some of the students would kind of directly say, you know, they're not decided yet between medicine or maybe a biomed degree as well. And there were a few, and when they would say that, the parents would kind of make little jokes or remarks about, oh, of course you want to do medicine. And you're just in that awkward position where you kind of want to tell the parent, this isn't your life, go away. It's something which, you know, some people do experience, but actually the amount of, I think, sort of helicopter parents that I saw on that day overwhelmed me a little bit. I wasn't expecting that.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, for me personally, that's really scary because, as you know, my family were the main and realistically only reason I was at university. It wasn't a decision I felt I was allowed to make any other choice on.
Yeah.
As we talked about a bit in the last time you were on. Yeah, so I can't help but kind of emotionally respond to that and just think of like little parallels of me out there that are not only being pressured into academia that may not be right for them, but also medicine is such a commitment.
Yeah.
And, you know, my parents are medical, and yet, as much as they would love me to have gone down that route, they're the first ones to say how hard it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, how much of their life they've given to the NHS.
Yeah. And I think that sums up well where it's not just the degree itself that's challenging. I think once you graduate, you're also giving up a lot of your life choices as well. I think to a certain extent, down to where you're living. If you have a particular training program you want to do, then you might pick where you live based on that rather than a particular area that you really want to stay in or stay in a family. I know, I think women in particular really struggle with having kids and knowing when is an appropriate time to take some time out of training to have kids, and will it affect their progress in their career. And as it isn't unique to medicine, but it does kind of take over your life in that
way. There's a certain severity of it in that career. For my mum, she talks about that quite openly, how having kids has delayed career progression for her. And now she's in a slightly weird period in that she's not that far from retirement, and yet she keeps making such big career jumps. And that is partly because she's now able to compete with people that don't have kids at home. You know, we're moved out, and I think that does make a difference. But the thing that's so intense about medicine is that I grew up with her being on a part-time contract and yet usually working 5 days a week. And in seemingly any other industry, that is full-time. It's upsetting to think about, but I'm sure there were people around her that judged her for dropping her hours, even though she was still giving so much of her time and energy and life to the NHS.
Definitely. And I think it's such a big commitment to ask people who are so young to make when it comes to applying for medicine. Well, I know that when I applied, I'd never considered stuff like that. I'd never thought about having kids and family and how medicine would affect my future like that. So I think that it is a lot of pressure to put on someone, especially if they're not 100% committed, and there's a lot of family pressure on it as well. I do sort of wonder how many of these people who are pressured into it will actually make it through the career, and how many will they kind of make it a year or two in and then leave, almost having wasted their time to go and do what they really want to do.
It's definitely a concern, and that's something I do speak about quite a lot. The university is painted as this sort of ideal that for so many people it's not. And certainly when you look at the stats around mental illness in university, there's so many people struggling like we did, and it's, you know, that's not acknowledged in the prospectus. You know, that's been a weird thing to kind of reflect on and be like, a lot of the services and support I needed the most weren't really promoted. You know, definitely. And yet though I'm not unique in having needed mental health support whilst at uni. It seems like quite an odd thing that's, I don't know, maybe somewhat put under the carpet.
Yeah, and I think something I've noticed coming back is there's a lot more promotion of mental health services. I mean, every year there's a big mental health awareness week all around the uni, and they put on a lot of great events. But I think my problem with it is it feels like there's a lot of awareness, but not much doing to match the awareness. And a lot of money must go into it just from all the promotional materials and a lot of the kind of free events that are put on. But then you try to get an appointment with the counselling service or the disability service, and there's like a month waiting list where you just can't get an appointment because they don't have enough people there to meet the demand that has almost come out of people being more aware that it's there. And so I think in some ways, I think at first I was quite excited to see how much more awareness there was and how much more effort and I think acknowledgement of students' mental health there was. But I think I've also just become a bit disillusioned. I think perhaps a bit sceptical in some ways of some of the sort of university campaigns that are put on.
I totally agree with that. And it really makes me think of something that I think can be a bigger problem, not just in medicine, but in terms of those that work in fields relating to mental health in general, that there can be this kind of mentality that you're either well or you're ill. And if you're the person providing the care, you have to be perfectly well. And for most people, that binary isn't really a thing. Certainly for people that have experienced mental illness, we all have ups and downs throughout our life. It's not really something you have once and then it disappears. If your situation was to change enough, you could go back to that place again. And so I think particularly in a field like medicine, that concerns me, the awareness but not the action, because it creates this paradox where seemingly things get better, that everyone's allowed to talk about mental illness more, there's permission given, but then if the resources aren't there, it almost says the talking's important but the help isn't.
Yeah, and I think that's something else I've been involved with in the past year, is volunteering as a crisis volunteer for a text service. And you get so many people who will text in with something that perhaps almost started off as, I'd say, quite a normal reaction to like a really rubbish life event, but then they've not had any help and they've not had any support, and it's just escalated and escalated, and it gets to the point where they're really struggling, they really need help, and there's only so much that I can offer to them in that sense. Our main aim is to help them to come up with their own coping techniques that will work for them, but also help them to get help from whatever resource that would be kind of most appropriate for them.
Yeah, this creates an ability to talk about mental health in the abstract, that you can talk about the stigma and you can talk about working in relation to it, but then you can't talk about mental illness specifically with yourself.
Yeah, because that's really true, actually. I've never really thought of it in that way, but I definitely agree that I don't think anybody in the medical profession would think that they're stigmatizing mental health problems. It's a very understanding profession, but actually people don't talk about their own mental health. And something which I think is a never-ending debate amongst doctors is how much to disclose of your own struggles to a patient who's going through something similar.
Right.
And when is it appropriate to say, I understand I've been through similar, or is that just an absolute boundary that you should not cross? And I think there'll never be a straightforward cut-off point that you can say, this is appropriate, this isn't appropriate. But I think quite often, because of the fear other people would judge you, or that somebody else would tell you that it wasn't appropriate, people don't want to reveal anything. They want to just keep it completely shut.
No, I would agree with that. But I think it does inadvertently create stigma, even if it's the best intentions of behaving appropriately. And it's the same with colleagues as well. You know, I know plenty of people that work in the NHS that are cautious about who they talk to their experience of mental illness to. Is it appropriate for me to speak to a colleague? And I'm like, if you can't speak to your colleague that's a doctor about your health, who can you speak to?
Yeah.
So to me, it's obvious that there is that link, and that actually, whilst we're not advocating a position where the doctor like pulls up a chair and is like, oh, let me tell you about what's happened to me, I can trump your story, and you know, then it kind of creating a weird role reversal when then the patient's worrying about you. Nothing as extreme as that, but by not mentioning it at all, or only mentioning it in the abstract, I think it can be quite stigmatizing. So if someone's genuinely sharing with, let's say, a GP about what they're going through, and all they ever feel comfortable in situations like that is to say, oh, it's really common, it happens to a lot of people. Some people may hear that and think they're downplaying it. They're like, oh, it's just normal, don't worry about it. Whereas if they'd said, it happens a lot, it's happened in my family, then it suddenly seems less impersonal and more like, oh, they really get it.
Yeah. And I think that's something which you hear a lot coming from patients saying, you don't understand, it's me going through this. And I think in situations like that, as you've said, if you just said, you know, I have been through this, I've come out the other side, something like that might actually give your patient a bit more hope and just help them to know that actually you do know what you're talking about. It's not just stuff that you've read in textbooks. But yeah, I think the fear comes from the idea that if you're really unwell, you're incompetent. And I think there's such a big fear as well that if your colleagues find out that you have a mental illness, that they're going to phone up the GMC and the GMC are going to phone you back and say, yes, we're getting rid of your registration. You can't be a doctor anymore. And it's just this big cycle of fear, I think, which stops people from talking out. And then because nobody speaks about it, nobody else does. And it just perpetuates the whole situation.
And whilst I do feel that's getting better, and certainly we are noticing changes in the stigma, it's always going to be tough. There's a lot of grey area in mental health. We often talk for comparison on the podcast about like breaking an arm as something quite kind of linear in terms of health. So yeah, if you're a doctor and you break your arm, well, you're going to need time off because you can't do most jobs in the NHS with only the use of one arm. And so there's a clear thing there, whereas with mental health, it's rarely like that.
Yeah.
And so I think that kind of reinforces the boundary that you're either perfectly well and you're at work, or you're ill and you're not at work. But yeah, actually, for the majority of people that experience mental illness, they are able to work.
Yeah.
You know, not maybe at some times during it, but it doesn't mean work is by any means a write-off for yeah, them. And I think that's part of why it's always going to be complicated. But that's equally why the conversations need to be had. Because if it's never talked about, instead what happens, these things get bottled up, not addressed, and then people get ill enough that then they have to take the time out.
Yeah. I suppose it's almost how do you tell at what point it's affecting their ability?
It's an understandable concern, but then I think there are similar factors that people do understand. So if you've come in on Monday morning and you've had a relationship breakup, you're going to probably mention it to your colleagues. In fact,
yeah,
one of the great things about healthcare is there's very much an encouragement of that, that you check in with each other on personal matters that may affect your work. And so people are able to a certain extent to kind of judge that and think, okay, how okay does this colleague seem?
Yeah.
Do they seem like in a good enough place to still perform at work? Is there anything I need to do to support them? I'm probably going to check in with them more times today. There's a clear understanding, but then that's partly because that's been established as something to talk about. It's actively yeah, encouraged. And therefore the grey area can be kind of worked through and understood. And I think unless that similar encouragement is made with mental health, there's always going to be this lack of understanding of what levels you can or can't be affected at work by.
Yeah.
But when talking about stigma as well, it's also good for us in this episode to trace it back. Do you feel that a lot of those around you would have benefited from greater education about mental health, in that even though they're in the medical profession, that more normalisation of these conversations from a younger age would have made a difference?
I definitely think it would, because I think a lot of where stigma comes from is just from not understanding it and having not been exposed to it. I know a lot of people going onto their psychiatry placements feel quite anxious about speaking and interacting with psychiatric patients. We are often exposed to the most unwell people will often be in acute units or forensic units where you have really unwell people. So I think a certain amount of apprehension is normal, but I do think a lot of it just comes from having never really been exposed to mental health problems. It's all just been kept under wraps and kept pushed up. And I've definitely seen a difference with high school students now. And I think a lot of it comes down to social media and YouTube. I think just generally sort of social media personalities being a lot more open about their mental health. And often they already have a much better understanding from the outset about it. And I found with going into schools, I think they've been a lot more receptive. And they already have, when you try to prompt them into coming up with ideas for coping mechanisms, or you ask them to come up with perhaps some signs that their friend maybe isn't doing so well. Once you kind of prompt them, they already know probably a good like 70-80% of the things that you want to teach them. And so it was really exciting to see that difference coming through. And I mean, I remember being in school, if somebody was sort of rumoured to self-harm or have an eating disorder, it was just the gossip of the school and that person was ostracised. Whereas now, while I don't think it's completely fine, I think kids are a lot more willing to help their friend instead of sort of bully them.
And that's really good. And that's, I think, a sign of how the overall narrative is changing, that in part because of campaigns like ours for mental health education, it creates a more normalised environment even before the specific education is reaching the curriculum. And so it's really great to hear that when you're speaking in schools, are already noticing these changes. That's really how fundamental this is. If we don't teach kids about their mental health, we're depriving them of the skills to remain healthy.
Yeah.
And with the flip side of physical health, that would seem incredibly inappropriate, even abusive, if we stripped away PE classes or if we stopped teaching kids about nutrition and food tech and instead were just like, good luck. That would be madness. Kids need to have the tools to look after themselves up to a point and know when they need to get support. Because as much as the support is out there so you don't have to have the burden of like having all the answers, it helps if you have at least some of them. If you at least know what common symptoms are, if you at least know what things like self-care are, it makes such a difference to people.
Yeah, and I definitely think that to a certain extent, there are situations where you almost do have to take on the responsibility for self-care in that way.
You have to have ownership of your own mental health, ultimately. No matter how many times you speak to a mental health professional or what kind of tests or quizzes they give you, they're never going to be as clued in on moment by moment how you're feeling as you are.
Yeah.
That is one of the intrinsic complications of mental illness, that we have an insight into it in a way that no one else does because it's happening inside us.
I think that's why it's so important to have this sort of teaching in schools as well, so that they're set up for all the challenges of the rest of life, of being an adult. And I think giving them the tools so that they're able to cope and they're able to manage all these difficulties in a much more healthy way.
Yeah, because it will affect every child.
Yeah.
If it hasn't already.
Yeah, you know, everybody has life stresses, whether it's a close friend or relative dying, or you might get fired from your job, you've got loads of exams, even sort of moving house and relationship difficulties. You know, it's, I would challenge anybody to get to the end of their life and say, oh yeah, it was a breeze. I just say what to do, everything.
Mm. Absolutely. And that is something that people are a lot more comfortable talking about, is stress. I can't think of anyone in my own life who would say they've never been stressed.
Yeah.
But there are plenty that would refuse to acknowledge they've experienced mental illness symptoms.
Yeah.
So even if you don't experience mental illness, there are still symptoms of it you might experience that aren't enough to be diagnosable. There's still day-to-day stress. And so a lot of these discussions are around coping with that, just coping with being human. One of the things that's important to talk about is the progress that's been made so far. So since we started campaigning for mental health education last year, we are now seeing it rolled out in England and Wales. Has just recently been confirmed. Both countries are going to have the education rolled out from September 2020, and I'm really lucky to have been part of the consultation on both, and that's allowed me to go through piece by piece what the education is. At the moment, it's education proposals, so it is very specific on here is a list of all the different parts of this that are going to be taught, but that's still subject to change. So that's part of the importance of keeping talking about this and keeping the momentum of the petition, is keeping that pressure on. I said keeping like seven different times. But it is vital that the pressure remains, because certainly when we've had progress in England and Wales, I have had that concern in the back of my head. what if they agree this to my face? And then go down the consultation route and things just start to slip away and it becomes kind of boiled down. And by the time it actually reaches the kids, it's really very narrow and doesn't cover a lot of what they really need.
Yeah, I think this is why it can be so important to have workshops and consultations with the people who these programs are aimed at mm-hmm. as well. And that's something which senior are really good at doing, is actually getting young people involved in processes like this. Because I think a lot of time, especially when it's young people, I think adults quite easily dismiss them and think, no, we know better. It makes me think of the Principal Skinner meme mm-hmm. where he says, like, is it me who's wrong? No, it's the kids. I think so many people genuinely look at it that way. Even within services that are designed to tackle these groups, it'll be adults designing it and adults coming up with the lesson plans. And I just think it's so important to make sure it is relevant, that people who will be going through it end up having some sort of input, or at least being able to look over the finalised plans and say, nah, this is rubbish, this is patronising, this is great. So I think it'll be interesting, and I really hope that it will follow through and will keep with the sort of ultimate aim in mind instead of becoming something that's a bit of a tick box.
But that is a great point about the importance of including people that are really close to the subject matter, whether that's the kids, whether that's people that are working in like mental health destigmatization like me, and charities like See Me. They have such brilliant insight.
Yeah.
Because to use kids as an example, they're living in an unprecedented time of internet accessibility.
Yeah.
I feel very lucky to have grown up in a time where I remember before mainstream social media. I remember when Facebook being this novel, weird thing, not where it is now, where social media is just seen as another type of communication,
yeah.
equal to speaking to someone on the phone, equal to going for a coffee with someone, because that's the way young people see it, that it's just another type of communication for them.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's so much more complication to it than that.
Yeah.
But the young people do see that, because yeah. they see it, I think, a lot as an equal medium to other types of communication, despite the fact they also see how fake a lot of it is. And those two things can't be true. Mm. It can't be fake and also real and as genuine as other types of conversation. And so I think that's been something really positive to see when going through these consultations, social media has been included. Things like we mentioned, self-care has been included. Self-care was one where I was, of course, really pushing for, but I wasn't sure if we'd be able to win the Department of Education and the Welsh Assembly over on that the first time round. I thought it may be a case that we get the education out there and then we add something like self-care, because they may see it as not as valid because it's not scientific like cortisol levels in the brain is, or it's not as easy to define as a mental illness with symptoms. Instead, self-care is a kind of general thing that can impact you far more than just your mental health, and so therefore maybe it's not explicitly relevant enough in a kind of maybe narrow scientific way. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's really weird to phrase, because obviously I'm all about self-care.
Yeah.
I absolutely believe in it, but I'm trying to put myself in the mindset of politicians that may try and explain away the relevance of something.
Yeah, and I think it's much easier to come up with blanket sort of lesson plans where it's focusing on facts and you can say, okay, here are the things that young people need to learn about. Whereas something like self-care, where it's very individual, but it's also going to change with the times as well. And I think social media is a really good example of something that changes quickly and will also massively impact what things kind of count as self-care or what things are maybe an additional life stress.
Right. We can't just be prescriptive to kids and just say, do the self-care without really teaching them what that is.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's all well and good for us to say, all right, kids, look after yourselves. But if there's not been a proper discussion on what that actually means and what impact that can have, it's going to be difficult for them to draw these lines.
Yeah.
Like there are, as you say, social media is a great example. There are elements of that that will be self-care for some people that won't be for others. I have plenty of introvert friends where an hour of watching TV and turning their phone off for it will be self-care in a way that for someone else, an hour of texting a friend or Facebook messaging or whatever it is, that'll be self-care for them.
Yeah.
You know, and that's getting them away from other life stressors. So it is complicated and it is ever evolving. But I think one of the really positive things I'm glad to be a part of is how broad this kind of education has been. The things I've been banging on about and the people that have signed the petition have been raising are being heard. And that's really cool. Another thing that's been really positive for me to see is how the respective governments are taking note on relationships as factors in mental health as well, because that's something I'm hugely passionate and have been very vocal about. And both England and Wales are going to have that as part of the larger reforms, that it's not just adding mental health education to PSHE. In fact, PSHE in England is being reformed completely. It's even being given a new name, which isn't finalised, just to be confusing, but probably something along the lines of relationship, health and sex education. So that'd be what? RSHE? Something like that. The whole thing is being reformed, and it's really great to see how that's being done in a broader, interconnected way, rather than just being like, okay, we're going to teach kids about these mental illnesses. It's also going to be, okay, here are how other factors of the curriculum can influence this as well. You know, here's what a healthy relationship looks like. Here's what a healthy relationship doesn't look like. Here's what types of relationships are appropriate as you grow older and when they're appropriate.
Yeah, all of those things that you mentioned are so closely intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can't just ignore the fact that relationships will have both positive and negative impacts on your mental health, and things to do with sexuality and sex education, it all comes into how it affects your relationships and your well-being. And I think trying to separate them doesn't really make sense.
Well, you're right in that they're all interconnected.
Yeah.
I totally agree with that. There are so many elements of young people's lives and the pressure they're under now, which are naturally anxiety-inducing, for example, like the level of pressure about relationships, the level of pressure not only to get into them, but then sexually, what your peer group may be pressuring you to do.
Yeah.
And that can't be overlooked. If someone's living with anxiety or not, it's going to cause them a level of stress just as a young person by default. And then if mental illness isn't acknowledged, well, then you're only looking at half the picture.
Yeah.
So it has been really positive to see these changes. One of the reasons why I'm so glad to be having this discussion with you whilst I'm in Edinburgh is because whilst all that progress is really incredible, and I'm delighted to have this episode to talk about all the wins so far, there is still so much to do. So whilst we've had support from any number of politicians across the board, including here in Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, for example, there's not hard and fast progress I'm seeing much of yet. And so I'm certainly going to be really focusing on, all right, how are we going to build that support? How are we going to get more MSPs on board with the written down confirmation that they're caring about this and they're going to do something about it? In the same way, I'll be putting that pressure on politicians in Northern Ireland. You mentioned something kind of off air, which was quite funny about, hopefully I can go to Nicola Sturgeon and say, all right, you've committed to this. You've said that you care about it. You've said that you're keen to see reforms like this in Scotland. We've got you on record saying it. England have done it and you've not. How do you feel about that, Nicola?
And I think all of a sudden we'll see a barrage of action happening.
Yeah, hopefully. So, and that is the funny thing about politics and about campaigning, that a lot of it is about being savvy. I wish it was a case of it being really prescriptive and us being able to just say, all right, if we get enough MPs on board, it's just going to happen. But actually, that's only part of the picture. A lot of it is around the ways you can apply pressure. Things like the petition obviously help a lot with that. The way you can kind of time who you're contacting, the way you can kind of somewhat play the parties off each other and say, well, Labour care about this. Conservatives, what are you doing?
Yeah. And I think as well, when you're in like the mental health world, we're really passionate about it. And it's one of the most important areas of your life. Mm-hmm. And so it can be quite hard to remember that these MPs have people for every single topic that you can imagine, all pressuring them to do X, Y, and Z. So I think it's really hard to remember that they're also trying to balance all of these issues at the same time, which is why you kind of have to keep putting pressure on and don't right. let them forget that we're still here, we're still wanting this.
Absolutely, that momentum has to continue. And this doesn't mean I get to stop pushing, not yeah. only in terms of the countries in the UK that are yet to introduce plans for mental health education, but also in terms of those that are already rolling it out. I'm still going to be very closely monitoring what that rollout looks like to make sure that things don't fall through the cracks.
Yeah.
And that there aren't delays and that there aren't things that are just conveniently forgotten.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's both a really great time to be campaigning for this, but also a time when there is still a mammoth task ahead. So we will start wrapping up now, but I just before that wanted to mention how not just have I seen brilliant progress in terms of the campaign and the milestones we've reached, but also the conversation around it has been so wonderful to see. It's opened up so many conversations with people that have signed the petition, who are supporting it, who are sending emails, tweeting, contacting MPs, doing all these wonderful things. And even more insular than that, in my own life and with the people we talk to on the podcast, it's great to see that they're all just by default for this. It's sort of like yeah. every day that goes by, I'm like even more confident the general narrative is changing and we're getting to be a part of that. So we'll just finish up with some calls to action. So if you're new to the podcast and you've not signed the petition, you can find it at bit.ly/mentalpetition. And that link is also going to be in this episode description. If you've already signed it, do continue pushing it to everyone you know. Of course, social media, but even just hand your phone to someone sitting next to you. Get them to sign it there and then. Every signature really does make a difference. When we present the case to new decision makers and re-present it to them, every time we do that with a document of the support so far. So that includes all the signatures, that includes comments of support, that includes politicians supporting it so far, progress so far. So all of this feeds into a huge body of evidence on why this needs to happen and why this needs to happen ASAP. So thank you to everyone that supported the cause so far. And thank you, Jenny, for being here to talk it all through.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on. And I'm really excited with the progress that the campaign's made. And I'm looking forward to see where it goes in the future.
Yeah, particularly Scotland, where you're based. That would be brilliant. So yeah, thanks for tuning in. That's everything from us.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.